From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The election of Donald Trump is expected to dominate a news conference that President Obama gives this afternoon before he boards Air Force One for his last official trip abroad. And Trump's first media interviews and job hires over the weekend are sure to come up. Joining us now is Rebecca Sinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. And let's talk about these two hires over the weekend. Trump campaign CEO and conservative media executive Steve Bannon to be senior counselor and chief West Wing strategist, and RNC chairman Reince Priebus is going to become the chief of staff. Sort of pulls in two different directions. What does it tell you?
Well, you know, it was interesting to look at that statement, a lot of parsing of that statement. It listed both of them, listed Bannon's name first, ahead of the incoming White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, and it stressed that the two would be equal partners. That tells you a lot about the position that Steve Bannon stands to hold in the West Wing. Of course, it was very interesting to see congressional reaction. You had plenty of congratulations pouring in for Reince Priebus, virtually none for Steve Bannon.
Well, and some people pointed out that if you look back to the Bush White House, you had Karl Rove and Andy Card in those two positions. And many people would look back and say Rove, the one who was a senior advisor, was more powerful.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, there's a lot of question marks swirling around this. Of course, many people instantly latching onto the fact that Steve Bannon has been a very controversial figure for a very long time. His Breitbart News site has stories and coverage that's considered offensive by many. And so the question is how much of that transfers over to the White House. We saw a lot of it in the campaign in the sense of Donald Trump was stopped in his tracks on the pivot. Steve Bannon told him, let Trump be Trump. Do whatever. Don't hold yourself back. And so the question is how much of that translates over to the West Wing. This sets up a dynamic of, you know, Reince Priebus is good cop. Perhaps Steve Bannon is bad cop.
Well, and we've already heard from the Anti-Defamation League, which said it's a sad day when a man who presided over the premier website of the alt-right, a loose-knit group of white nationalists and unabashed anti-Semites and racists, is slated to be a senior staff member in the People's House. That's a quote. Is any of this backlash likely to make a difference?
You know, it's hard to see that making a difference at this point. You know, we heard a lot of this criticism when Bannon was first brought on board the Trump campaign months ago, and it didn't result in him getting dislodged from his position in the Trump campaign. So clearly Donald Trump is aware of this criticism, and he's processed it into the way he views Steve Bannon and relies on Steve Bannon. So it would have to be some sort of new pressure coming from some new source or new information. It's not clear what that would be.
We heard from Donald Trump on 60 Minutes on CBS last night. Leslie Stahl asked him whether he'd appoint Supreme Court justices that would overturn Roe v. Wade, the 1973 abortion rights decision. Here's what he said.
If it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
but
it would go back to the
some
states.
Some women
and the states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to, they'll have to go to another state.
And that's okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's got a long way to go.
Okay, so on that case, he said it's got a long way to go. But then he also commented on court cases involving the legalization of same-sex marriage.
These cases have gone to the Supreme Court. They've been settled. And I'm fine with that.
What does that tell you about how he sees the court? And he's going to be able to make at least one pick.
Right. A lot of people are pointing to that contrast this morning. If you're trying to come up with a grand unified theory of Donald Trump's judicial philosophy, it's very difficult to square those two positions. On the one hand, pointing to a case law that's less than 2 years old and saying that it's settled law. On the other hand, pointing to a case that's more than four decades old and saying that it's not settled. At some level, of course, this results from positions he's taken during the campaign. He is not someone who's been anti-abortion rights throughout his entire career. But this is the position he finds himself in. There are some lines that he's been able to cross. This may not be one of them.
Do you expect Congress to work with him, or what are you sensing from what they're saying? Are there going to be battles with even a Republican Congress?
And this is the big question. There are a number of issues where Donald Trump, what Donald Trump campaigned on, is in direct opposition to the stated positions of a majority of the Republican caucus. We've already seen some of these splits developing in the week since Election Day. So, you know, we're heading into a new session. There's a lot of optimism on the Republican side about pushing the agenda through. On the other hand, again, Donald Trump may find that when he goes to the Hill, that his hand gets forced in ways that he may not expect. He's just now learning how Washington works, getting a lot of surprises. And so it'll be interesting to see exactly where he lands.
That's Rebecca Sinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Rebecca, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And let's take a deeper look at President-elect Trump's decision to appoint Steve Bannon his chief strategist. Bannon, again, was executive chair of Breitbart News, which has been called the mothership of the alt-right and a message board for white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and misogyny. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
And let's start with Breitbart, founded by Andrew Breitbart in 2007, in part because he said he wanted a pro-Israel media outlet. He died in 2012. There were reportedly internal fights over the tone of the site. And now you have a former Breitbart writer, Ben Shapiro, saying Breitbart is a movement shot through with racism and anti-Semitism. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, the one thread of consistency from the late Andrew Breitbart's founding of the site was the idea that the conservative media was too much in step with the establishment and with the Republican Party, and that the media itself was enmeshed in the establishment. And it kind of all got intertangled. And he said, let's take the narrative away. What Breitbart has become is, in some ways, a place. Look, it's not Stormfront, right, the white racist website. But there's a lot of stuff there that is deeply offensive to people of color, to Latinos, to one
women.
Of their lead columnists said, you know, that feminism is cancer. You know, there's just a series of ways in which they incite certain kinds of essentially bigotry. And, you know, when I talked to Kurt Bardella, he used to be he's a former Capitol Hill staffer who works as a used to work as the PR strategist and consultant for Breitbart. And he said it was by design to stir up the portion of Breitbart's readership that was essentially racist or essentially bigoted and stir them up to both make their writings viral and get involved on their message boards, but also to put pressure on conservative members of Congress to be more conservative and to be more nationalist and to be more anti-immigrant. And you can go down a list of issues. But that this is very much not a bug, but very much part of the design of Breitbart under Steve Bannon are these kinds of rhetoric that many people understandably find very hateful.
Well, here's a headline. People have talked about this one headline from just this past August, heat of the campaign. Bill Kristol, Republican spoiler, renegade Jew. You know, that's both the anti-Semitism, but also, as you say, throwing down a gauntlet to the old Republican media.
Well, and Republican Guard, you know, yeah. Bill Kristol came into the sort of public view as the chief of staff for Dan Quayle when he was vice president. And Kristol, obviously, part of the conservative establishment media. But the idea of renegade Jew, making that a noun, making that the point of the headline, you know, and a renegade somehow, that he's not entitled to his own thoughts. And the kinds of truly hateful anti-Semitic in particular and anti-women in particular imagery and rhetoric being pointed at many journalists or other critics of Donald Trump in the course of this campaign by people who are of this sort of alt-right movement who find themselves a hospitable home, if nothing else, on the pages of Breitbart.com. You know, it's a deeply disturbing connection for many people. You know, I've experienced a small taste of it. Our colleagues and many others have experienced it in much worse ways.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we talked about Breitbart, but I was surprised how many people on social media last night didn't really know what the alt-right was. And it's being discussed, you know, the phrase is being used as if everyone understands. What is the alt-right?
Well, the idea is that the idea of this is that it's the alternative right. It's in somehow the conservatives have been failed, true conservatives and true patriots and true nationalists have been failed by Republicans, and that they need to step outside of that and be this disruptive force. And folded into that is, to my mind, a lot of truly hateful groups, some of them sort of coalescing nebulously on social media, 4chan, using Twitter, using other social media outlets to both get their messages out and to try to enforce some sort of a retribution on those who take critical lines. And they have embraced both Breitbart and also the Trump candidacy in ways that, you know, Trump, until really the interview broadcast last night on 60 Minutes, has taken pains not to disassociate himself from. Mm-hmm. The reason that Steve Bannon is in the White House is that he serves as a liaison to this part that's by no means the majority of Trump voters, but certainly this significant and important part of the Trump coalition that helped him to win in the key states that pushed and propelled him to victory last week.
Well, and a lot of people are saying, Wesley Lowry from The Washington Post tweeted last night, it's journalistic malpractice if next interviews with Bannon don't include questions about if he still hates Jews. But also, quick question as we wrap here, will Bannon use Breitbart as the White House newspaper, maybe banning other papers?
Well, there's that question, right? I mean, Donald Trump definitely used a lot of the mainstream media to be able to campaign in a way that meant he didn't have to spend the kind of money a conventional campaign might require. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, his favorite news outlets are places like the National Enquirer and Breitbart. And I think you'll see that less as a place that he only turns to offer news, but also that Steve Bannon will use that as an enforcement mechanism against those Republicans who don't embrace a nationalist agenda from Donald Trump's administration.
Dave and Folkenflik, thanks as always.
The Showtime show Shameless is in the middle of its seventh season. It's actor William H. Macy's latest project. He is probably best known for his Oscar-nominated performance in Fargo from 1996. He played a car dealer who hires two crooks to kidnap his wife so he can get the ransom money. Here's Macy being questioned by the sheriff, played by Frances McDormand.
Have you done any kind of inventory recently?
The car's not from our lot, ma'am.
But how do you know that for sure without doing a...
Well, I would know. I'm the executive sales manager.
Yeah, but I understand.
We run a pretty tight ship here.
I know.
In Showtime's Shameless, Macy stars as Frank Gallagher, an alcoholic whose drinking impacts not only his life, but the lives of his grown children.
We make mistakes, have faults. Lips drinking his breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Ian's a bipolar queer. Deb's 15 with a baby on her hip.
William H. Macy has received 3 Emmy nominations for his role on Shameless, and he joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. I'm pleased to be here. I'm a fan of NPR and Here and Now.
Well, thank you so much. And let me ask you this, because this show is not about a president. It's not about a terrorist attack. It doesn't have any dragons in it. Why do you think so many people have come back to it for 7 seasons? Now, it's a difficult topic to take, really.
It is. I think people like it because at the end of the day, it's about this family and they get each other's back, as they say on the street. And I think that's very compelling. It's the Gallagher family is really one paycheck away from being homeless. They really live on the edges, but they're really great kids. It was beautifully cast in the beginning. And I play the ne'er-do-well – not ne'er-do-well. I play the reprobate father. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I'm just the bane of their existence. And it's this weird love-hate relationship. And what I hear from a lot of people that watch the show is, oh, my God, there's a Frank Gallagher in my family too. Mm. My father was like that. Boy, could I tell you stories. So it just rings – the bell of truth for so many people.
Well, what is it about that character, Frank, that has brought you back to it year after year now?
Oh, my Lord, I've got the best character on television. He is, well, he's shameless. At the beginning of the thing, he was a drinking alcoholic and drug addict. And it was very interesting to do scene after scene after scene in some form of inebriation. And they say, how can you tell if an alcoholic is lying to you or a drug addict is lying to you? Well, his lips are moving. And that was Frank. He was just a wheeler and a dealer and determined to never work a day in his life and to sponge off of his family. And when he would get drunk, he would just do the most awful things. And they throw him out of the house all the time. And he keeps coming back. And over the years, Frank's character has become more and more complex. This past season, it came out that Frank did 3 years of college and dropped out when he met Monica, his wife, the mother of the children. And they started getting high together, and they've stayed high for the last, 30 years. And one episode, he sits down and he starts playing the piano. And everyone says, who knew Frank could play the piano? So it's a very multifaceted character. He's very smart and he's funny and he's quick-witted and he's pretty knowledgeable. And then you combine that with the fact that he's loaded most of the time.
Well, and how is it to play somebody who is drunk when I assume you're sober when you're doing it?
To a certain extent, it's a parlor trick. The danger in it is that you walk away from a scene saying, well, that was a great drunk I just did. And then you remember, oh, I forgot to act the scene. I guess inebriation is not an unknown quality to me. And there are tricks that you can do. And, well, it's great fun. And I would sort of, over the past 7 years, I would talk to myself about, well, how loaded is he? And I would judge the scene that way.
Now, this show is set in Chicago. We read that when John Wells, the showrunner, first pitched it, he got suggestions that it take place somewhere rural, maybe in a trailer park in the South or something like that. Why do you think Chicago is such a good place for this show? Because it is really a part of the show, the city.
It really is. It's the center of the country. It's a hard-working town. It's, I think it's the center of the country on many levels, politically, culturally. It's right smack in the middle. It's not L.A. and it's not New York. John has said that had we done this in the South and put a Southern accent on these people, you would have characterized them and perhaps discarded them or dismissed what they were going through as just a bunch of hicks. And by setting it in Chicago, it's in a working-class neighborhood. It just has more resonance somehow.
You spent some time in your career in Chicago doing live performance,
right? Oh, yeah. It's very sweet. I started my career there. Dave Mamet was my mentor from college, and he wrote my good buddy Stephen Schachter and myself. We were here in Los Angeles trying to do some theater after college, and he said, no, I just did this play, Sexual Perversity, in Chicago. It's a big hit. Come out here. And it was inconvenient. I just found a girlfriend and bought a motorcycle, but I had to get rid of both. And I moved to Chicago, and I lived there for 10 years. And after about 2 years, we put a down payment on a warehouse and built a theater.
Huh.
And we were off to the races. The first play we ever did was American Buffalo. Hmm. And the first three plays we did were sold-out hits. So we kind of own that town.
Do you miss live performance?
I do. It's hard. I did a play about 3 or 4 years ago, it's a lot of work, man. It's a lot of work. I think for a civilian, you'd think, well, you work from 8 to 10 in the evening. That's not a full job, but it is. That's all you can do all day.
Hmm. You've also taught acting, and you and Dave Mamet founded the Atlantic Acting School. What do you tell young actors? What's the one thing that you want them to take away?
Well, I stopped teaching at a point, and just to be blunt, I started to listen to some of the crap I was saying, and I just thought, oh, my God, I can't do this anymore. And I look back on all the teaching I did, and it is my fond hope that I didn't hurt anybody. I'm not sure I taught anyone anything.
What was the crap you were saying?
Oh, you know, all this technique stuff, and what I was starting to see was that what a lot of actors do is they use technique or some theory instead of acting. It's always been a conundrum in this business that you can have somebody walk onto a film set or a stage with no training and be brilliant, and then you get somebody who's been studying it his or her whole life, and they're not very good. The vast majority of what you need comes from God. You got the talent or you don't have the talent. And the other stuff, you can learn pretty quickly. And interestingly, my daughter is going into the business. She's going to LACSA, which is the Performing Arts High School here. And so I, of course, have been talking to her about acting. And I finally synthesized what you need to do to one sentence. And I said, okay, at the end of the day, this is what it's got to be. It's got to sound like you're making everything up and you've never said it before.
Hmm.
The end.
You mentioned your daughter. I have to point out that you're also married to Felicity Huffman, the actress, and unlike almost every celebrity couple we can think of, you guys are still married 19 years later with two kids. How does that work? How do you make that work in Hollywood in a way that so many others haven't?
Oh, I don't think it's just in Hollywood. I think it's hard to be married. The only thing I can say is marry Felicity Huffman and everything will work out well. I just got lucky, man. There's nothing more than that. I just got lucky. We adore each other and we both love this business and it's the foundation of so much of what we do together. And she wants nothing but success for me and me back at her. I don't think we've been jealous of each other at all, ever. Hmm. It just works really well. I'm a lucky guy.
So what's next for you? What do you want to do next? Or how much longer will we continue to have you in Shameless?
We're going to do two more seasons. That's a rumor, but I'm starting it. I'm pretty sure we're coming back for one more. This is the end of the original contract, the seven seasons. But I think we're going to do at least one more, possibly two, and possibly three. I directed a film I started directing recently, and it's called Crystal, and I'm just doing the score now with this wonderful composer, Dan Romer. And we submitted to Sundance. And then the one I did before this, it's called The Layover, and that recently sold. And so I'll be doing some press for that. And I think that's it. You know, I did these films sort of back to back in my hiatus, and I'm knackered. I don't want to do anything for a while.
Is there another William Macy that you're distinguishing yourself from with the H, or why have you always had the H?
Bill Macy. Remember Maud, the TV show?
Yeah.
Maud? He played her husband, and he was in a wonderful movie called The Late Show. Terrific actor. I finally met him, and anyway, he got Bill Macy, so I, for a while, was W.H. Macy. But I noticed that when I went to an audition, people would skip my name because they'd see W.H. and they didn't want to say W.H., so they'd skip me. And so I sort of unilaterally took on William H. Macy, and the union never said I couldn't do it. So my dad liked that because I'm a junior.
Well, William H. Macy, Emmy-nominated star of Showtime's Shameless, which is in its seventh season right now. Thank you so much for joining us. Great having you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And tonight, the full moon will be super. It will be the biggest, brightest, and closest supermoon of the year. It's also the closest supermoon since 1948. Joining us now is Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you for joining us. And what is a supermoon?
You know, you'd think that the moon orbits the Earth in a perfect circle, but it doesn't. Its orbit is a little lopsided. Sometimes it's about 5% closer, 5% farther away. And this is one of those times when the Earth and the sun combine together to draw the moon closer than usual. So it is, you know, about 8% larger in the sky, about 16% greater in area. And it's just one of those things that happens in the clockwork of the solar system. It's going through what we call a really close perigee. And it also happens that the moon is full at this time. So it's special all around.
But why is this supermoon, because we understand it's one of three in a series. It's the second, I think, of three in a series. Why is it different from other supermoons?
Well, it's different. So the moon goes through perigee every month and comes, you know, about 5% closer than average. But this happens to be, first of all, it's occurring at the same time as the full moon,
right.
So that makes it kind of special. And at this time of the year, you might not realize this, we are closer to the sun, about 2% more closer than on average.
Hmm.
And so because of that, the sun's gravity is greater. The Earth is drawing the moon together in a line. You know, we're all kind of lined up at full moon. And it just happens to be nudging the moon a little bit closer than average.
Okay.
So when I looked at it last night, and that wasn't the peak here, but it looked pretty big to me. People like you, and I've seen others say this today, well, I can't really tell if it's that much bigger. So what's the deal?
Yeah. So I'm kind of in the business of looking up at the night sky and it was beautiful last night. And knowing that, I still couldn't convince myself that it was obviously bigger or brighter than usual. Now, we should point out that the actual time of this was this morning at 6:23 a.m. Eastern time, 3:23 a.m. Pacific. And that's kind of inconvenient for moon watching. So either last night or tonight, it'll look about the same.
Well, Kelly, you just put a big groove kill on this whole thing by saying that you couldn't see if it was bigger. To most of us, it's this enormous disk, this orange disk. And I can only imagine, back in the day, people seeing this must have run for cover or begun praying. thing.
You know, I don't want to raise expectations that they're going to see something wildly out of the ordinary. And in fact, there's no historical reference to these exceptionally large
really?
Full moons going back thousands of years. That said, Robin,
yeah.
I want to encourage everyone to go out and take a look at the full moon because it's just terrific to look at, as you point out. And, you know, from Sky and Telescope's point of view, anytime we can get somebody out looking at the night sky, that's a good
especially
thing.
Especially during the rise.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the next supermoon is going to be?
2034.
Ah.
So this close. I mean, supermoons, this notion of supermoons, first of all, is something fairly recent. We don't use it at Sky and Telescope. In 1979, an astrologer came up with that term, and it's kind of stuck. But these close moons do happen. Again, it's part of the sort of clockwork of the solar system. And what's really interesting is that the tides, because it's closer, might be just a little bit higher than normal.
So you got to wait 18 years to do this again. So go out and look at it. Kelly Beatty, Sky and Telescope expert. Thanks as always.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Hillary Clinton told donors on a conference call this weekend that FBI Director James Comey's announcement about her emails just about 2 weeks before the election stopped our momentum. But liberal columnist Frank Bruni's headline was, "The Democrats screwed up." And George Packer wrote in The New Yorker that the party ignored the white working class, for which former MSNBC host Crystal Ball said in The Huffington Post, "The Democratic Party deserves to die." David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He uses a baseball metaphor. He writes, "The Democrats let Donald Trump steal their base and head for home." David joins us from Pittsburgh. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And you were quoting a leading Pittsburgh executive who'd worked in Democratic campaigns who made that, you know, analogy to Donald Trump coming in and what?
Well, basically stealing the base of the Democrat Party. The Democratic Party was, the modern Democratic Party was formed in 1928 with Al Smith and 1932 with Franklin Roosevelt. It was white working people. It was people who felt on the margins, the poor and the striving. And those are the people whom Donald Trump seemed to get.
Yeah, well, this gentleman you spoke with said the Democrats let a guy come in and say he was going to bring back those jobs. But aren't the Democrats, and this seems to be the complaint of everyone that I just mentioned, that the Democrats have turned away from the working class to what, the white educated professional class?
Well, they seem to be both of and for people who work at universities, people who are minorities, and they are very coastal.
Well, and Crystal Ball makes the same point. She's the former Democratic congressional candidate, but also a commentator for MSNBC. She writes a scathing piece in the Huffington Post saying, you know, the coal mines are gone, the steel mines are closed. In the face of Trump's willingness to boldly proclaim without facts or evidence he'd bring these good times back, we, the Democrats, offered a tepid gallows logic. Well, those jobs are gone for good, we knowingly told them. We offered a fantastical non-solution. We will retrain you for good jobs. Never mind that these good jobs didn't exist in East Kentucky or Cleveland. Aren't the Democrats, you know, haven't they been really in a difficult position here? Because how can you promise jobs that most economists say are not coming back to those regions? And I distinctly remember when President Obama talked about retraining people. But as she says, you know, those jobs aren't yet there in those areas. And the money wasn't there from Congress to retrain people. So what could Democrats do?
Well, first of all, that illuminates the center of the entire election, which is while Donald Trump may not have had a prescription for bringing jobs back, he certainly had a diagnosis for the ailments and ills of all of those voters who voted with him. Now, he had no prescription, but he had a diagnosis. Mrs. Clinton didn't have really either. And that's the problem the Democrats have. I don't know how you bring jobs back to areas like Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. And maybe Donald Trump doesn't know either. But at least he spoke to that despair. He spoke to that need in a way that the Democrats didn't.
Yeah. So what do the Democrats do?
Well, the first thing the Democrats do is what they always do, is to hold a seminar at Harvard and try to figure out what went wrong.
Which further alienates them.
That's correct. Right. And after they do that, they're going to have to look into their own souls and wonder exactly what kind of party they are. Now, it may make demographic sense in the long term, though not in 2016, to be the party of professional women and to basically say, Virginia, you're gone, but we got New Jersey instead. That may be a long-term very, very smart calculation, and they have to figure out whether that was or not.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the Democrats can point to the fact that they did actually win the popular vote by hundreds of thousands of votes. Some might say, well, just be more tactical. Just go to those counties in Wisconsin and Michigan that Donald Trump went to and win those.
Well, let's at least start with go to Wisconsin at all, which she didn't do since she got the nomination. You know, when she came to this area here, she went and spoke at the University of Pittsburgh. Well, every one of those people was already going to be for her. She didn't seem to go into places where she wasn't going to get a lot of votes.
Yeah, well, that's not what you're talking about anyway. You're talking about, you know, not being strategic and, you know, targeting a couple of counties. You're talking about changing the attitude of the party towards, you know, the problem.
Well, and also trying to figure out what is the nature and character of this party. Is it, in fact, the legatee of Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy? Or is it really an Eisenhower kind of party? Or is it Adlai Stevenson's party finally? You know, there's this wonderful story about Adlai Stevenson. Somebody came up to him during the 1956 campaign and said, Governor Stevenson, every thinking person is going to be for you. And he said, yes, I know that. But I need a majority. And Governor Stevenson understood what Hillary Clinton didn't understand, which is people who don't have degrees do have the vote. She has to decide, not she anymore, but the party has to decide exactly what its message is and who it is.
Well, before the election, you wrote a piece about this, Democrats, the party of the professional class, ? And you seem to have taken away that question mark. And you quote James Carville saying that for years we were in the fight for the guy in the truck with a gun rack. We lost those guys. The best thing that happened to us is that we lost that war. You know, is that what you're talking about, the attitude that we don't need them?
That may well be the right strategy for 2020 when the party speaks to minorities, who will be a growing part of the U.S. population, speaks also to college-educated people, which also is a growing part of the population. So it may be a smart strategy for 2020, but it was a disaster for 2016.
Well, but it's not just an issue of jobs. There's a cultural issue, a cultural war. Because as you write, yes, the Democrats have to, you know, be more cognizant of the white working class, but they're getting pummeled from the left, from liberals who think they've watered down their commitment to progressive policies and are out of touch on that side as well, even though on the other side they've got conservatives who regard them as so liberal with issues like, you know, gay marriage, for instance, that they're completely out of touch with that constituency.
Well, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont make a good case. And they will, before this week or month is out, I guarantee they'll start describing themselves as members of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Now, their analysis isn't that much different from Donald Trump's. The themes are the same, and so maybe Mrs. Clinton ought to have spoken in that language, although she wasn't comfortable with it. She's not a populist. She's not a pugilist, and maybe she was just at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. Talk some more about what you think the party does going forward. The coal jobs, the steel jobs, many of the manufacturing jobs are not coming back. So when President Donald Trump can't produce them either, you might still have that angry base looking for a leader.
Right, but many of the people who had steel jobs have moved on or died. So we, and I have to stop doing this as well, we have to stop worrying about the people who used to work in steel mills here in Pittsburgh. They left here about 25 years ago. They've settled in Washington and Charlotte and in Houston, and some of them went to South Dakota even to get telemarketing jobs. So the notion of trying to speak to steelworkers is kind of out of date. There are only 200 or so left here in Pittsburgh.
So given that, you know, what should the Democratic Party do?
They have to be a little less fancy. They have to be a little less erudite, maybe, a little more comfortable in their own skin, and they have to find a candidate who can vocalize what it means to be a Democrat.
And David, just one last question. This whole conversation has been boiled down to the Democrats are the party of the elites. You know, a lot of people...
Let's just take a second and reflect on that. The party of the elites used to be the Republicans.
Right.
And the irony here is the party of the establishment no longer has an establishment itself, and the Democrats became the party of the establishment. Of course, they were for so many years, but it's not a place to run from.
Well, but staying with this notion, some would say it was that whole notion was cooked up by Republicans calling Democrats the elites. But I was going to ask if that's a false narrative. There are a lot of people in the Democratic Party, those out on the streets protesting Donald Trump, who wouldn't see themselves as elite.
No, the whole notion of what an elite is has become basically corrupted. If you're a violinist, you want to be in the elite orchestra. And believe me, if you have a child who needs heart surgery, you want an elite surgeon. But we have debased the notion of elites because we think it's a bunch of people sitting in eating houses at Princeton. The notion of being elite used to be a compliment. Now it's derisive.
That's David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. David, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you so much. This was fun.
A study out today finds more than a million international students studied at U.S. colleges and universities during the last academic year. That is the highest number ever. The number of American students studying abroad has also been climbing. The report comes from the Institute of International Education and the U.S. State Department. And joining us now is Alan Goodman, president and CEO of the Institute of International Education, which manages more than 200 study abroad programs, including Fulbright's. Alan Goodman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And was there anything surprising to you in this report?
Made in the USA is still the number one driver of international education. America is the leading destination for international students. It's been that for nearly a century, and I expect it will continue. So we will see more students in the years ahead coming to our schools.
And where are they coming from as you look at the numbers in this report, and what are they studying?
Well, demography matters. So China and India are the two biggest countries in the world, and not surprisingly, they are the biggest sending countries of students here and to many other countries. And they study a full range of things, from undergraduate liberal arts programs to the science and engineering fields at the graduate level. So international students take advantage of the diversity of American higher ed.
And the top schools that they're coming to study at?
NYU in New York, USC in California. But the neat thing about America is we have so many very good schools distributed all across the United States, not just a bicoastal situation. So international students now are pretty much everywhere, and that benefits our kids because they get to sit next to somebody from India, China, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and get a sense of how they think.
What about American students traveling abroad to study? What are we seeing there?
Well, we're seeing a consistent increase, now over 300,000, but it's still a very small number in comparison to the nearly 20 million Americans that are in higher education. And our aim is to make international a part of everybody's education, not only foreign students coming here, but Americans going abroad. It's what you need to work and compete in the 21st century.
Why do you think more students aren't doing it then?
Many obstacles, and we've launched a decade-long study to try to figure out which are the most important. At the beginning, we thought it was financial, but a lot has to do with scheduling, a lot has to do with curricular requirements, a lot has to do with perceptions of safety abroad. And so if we can help students navigate that, we think we can get more. And our most popular book is actually A Parent's Guide to Study Abroad. We've published it both in English and in Spanish so that especially first-generation parents and their children can understand how to do this and how important it is.
Have you seen any changes in where U.S. students are going or what they're studying?
Quite a bit. A decade ago, most U.S. students would be studying in the four or five countries of Western Europe, either where English is spoken, Great Britain, Ireland, or the traditional destinations, Italy, Spain, Germany, France. Today, it's really quite dispersed. There is the rise of China. There is renewed interest in the Middle East. So increasingly, American students are studying all over the globe, and I think that reflects the sense that this is a global marketplace. This is a global talent pool, and our students are looking to connect in many different places.
this is a story about education, both here and abroad, but everything is connected these days, and it seems like there's no story that doesn't come back to the election we just saw. Now, Donald Trump had called for a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. He had called Mexican immigrants rapists during the campaign. Do you think that his rhetoric is going to make a difference when it comes to foreign students coming into this country?
In nearly a century of tracking the flow of students to America, there have only been two dips, one immediately after the Iranian Revolution, and that was the Ayatollah Khomeini's doing, and the other was immediately after 9/11 when we were in the process of changing our visa regulations and our visa process. Since then, we've changed it. Students have adapted to it, and the numbers are robust. And one of the major sending countries today to America is Saudi Arabia through the King Scholarship Program. And I believe as long as there are national scholarship programs, people will want to come to America.
That's Alan Goodman, the president and CEO of the Institute of International Education, which manages more than 200 study abroad programs and has just come out with a new report about where American students are going to study abroad and what's happening with foreign students coming here to the U.S. Alan Goodman, thanks.
Thank you.
And if you're a foreign student here in the U.S., we'd love to hear from you. Why did you come here to study? And do you intend to stay in the United States when you're done? You can leave a comment at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.